Hey, I'm MJ Taylor, also known as a black wine guy. I went from being a totally obsessed wine newbie to becoming the world's first ever African-American fine and rare wine auctioneer in less than 3 years. In this show, I'll be talking to the mavericks, the philosophers, the players, and the deep thinkers who inhabit the world of wine. They'll share their experiences on how they made it, but more importantly, how they failed and got back up again. So grab a glass and let's get to it. This is the Black Wine Guy Experience.
All right. So, thanks, Josh. So we're actually, I was talking to Saul, and I think what we're going to do, like, I am transitioning the podcast to Beats, Vines, and Life, but I want to keep this fresh, so we're going to push this out next week. So, you guys, this is officially the last episode of the Black Wine Guy Experience. Right? All right, so here we go. Hey, everybody, what's up? It's your boy, MJ. Welcome to the Black Wine Guy Experience. My guests today are Josh Messina, general manager of Jada Vineyard, and his winemaker, Nate Hall. Doing this live in Paso Robles. It's a beautiful setting. I wish you guys could be here. And as I said, this is the last episode of the Black Wine Guy Experience. Stay tuned. So we're going to keep this one on a nice tight because I have a long format podcast that I thoroughly enjoy, but we don't want to bore the people here. They might not want to meander through it. And we got a lot of stuff to cover. All right. So let's just start by Josh next to me. Josh, tell everybody what you do here, where you're from. Tell everybody what you do here. Let's do that.
All right. Yeah. So I was part of the founding family of Jada all the way back in 1999. And so I've probably done every job here, including mop the floors. But I'm the GM now. I was the CFO for over 13 years. And this has just been the passion of a lifetime for me and my family.
Yeah, and I'm Nate Hall. I've been working here at Jada for the last 7 years. I'm the winemaker. I got hired about 7 years ago as the assistant winemaker. During those 7 years, I was working under a previous winemaker, Josh Harp, kind of crafting the brand that we know as Jada today. So these wines are very close to my heart for sure.
Awesome. All right. So I do like to get a little bit of the backstory because, I mean, there's a lot of stuff we're going to talk about. But, you know, a lot of stuff's in the tech sheet, so we don't necessarily have to go over it. And I'm from New Jersey, so there might be some cursing, so I hope you don't. I'm not going to talk about shit you can read on the internet, okay? And you mentioned Jersey Girl. So where are you, where did you grow up? And tell everybody a little about your parents, your mom and dad.
So I grew up actually in Westchester, New York, in Rye, kind of a very preppy town. But we don't come from really fancy roots. My dad was a Brooklyn kid, grew up in Bensonhurst, and my grandfather came over when he was 14 in the 1930s and actually bought property in Staten Island and made wine there. And that's really, my dad grew up watching them make, his dad and his uncle make wine, and it just stuck with him. And, that was really, I think, the inspiration many years later for Jada.
Did he come to Ellis Island?
He did, yeah.
What part of Italy was he from?
So he's from Sicily. Our last name is Messina, and in Italy, you're often, if you're a bastard child, you're named after the town you were born in. So we assume, again, humble roots. So.
That totally tracks, because you said he bought land in Staten Island, a.k.a. Shaolin, a.k.a. the Wu-Tang Clan, a.k.a. the Fulton Bastard. So, you know, you actually should do one. ODM, Old Dirty Messina.
There you go.
That's really cool. How about you? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I grew up in Santa Rosa up in Sonoma County. I kind of took not a direct route to winemaking, but I grew up in the wine country up there, interacting with, family, friends, and other people in the wine industry. And so it was always kind of something in the back of my head of something to try to do as I, started my professional career. I went to school here at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, which brought me to the Central Coast. I fell in love with this area, and when it kind of came down to figuring out what I wanted to do with my life, I decided to get a temporary job at a winery. I worked at Sexton for a harvest in 2013 and just completely fell in love with winemaking and fell in love with the winemaking process, the craftsmanship, but also the science behind winemaking. And so I haven't looked back since I started there.
So safe to say you grew up with wine on the table.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
Okay. How about you? You grew up with wine on the table. You're up in wine country.
Yeah, for sure. My my dad actually is an architect up in Sonoma County, and his firm specializes in wineries. So it was definitely...
That's why I ask these questions. Like, it's all these connections to the industry, right?
Yeah, so I grew up going to wine... Like, I would go to my dad's job sites and meet winemakers and meet people in the wine industry. And it always struck me as... it always struck me how happy these people seemed and just how much they loved their jobs and how much they loved what they were doing and interacting with the people that they worked with as well. And so that's always something that was in the back of my head growing up was, you know, this could be a cool path to follow one of these days. That's
cool. And so we know what your dad did. What did your father do to be able to acquire this in the first time?
So my dad's kind of the true immigrant story, second generation. He was a cardiovascular and thoracic surgeon. And even though we had those roots in wine, we were kind of accidental tourists to this industry. And my dad fell in love, especially in the 80s and 90s, with Bordeaux. He kept going there and just got hooked and started collecting and started coming out to Paso back in, all the way back in 1991. And at that time, it was really rare to get east. Most of the properties were on the east side. It was really hard to find properties on the west side. It's even hard today. And he came out here one last time, and we kept drilling for water on this property. We couldn't find any, and he told the guys, drill one more time. And it was like an oil gusher. It just exploded, and that's how we ended up with this estate.
Well, that's kind of crazy, like, because I lived in California for 10 years, and I was up in Santa Barbara in 99. And, okay, so you had Eberle, you had J. Lohr. But by and by, the wines here were suspect. Yes. And that's 99. Yeah. And he's coming out here in 91.
Yeah.
Like, that's really some dedication. And that story you just shared, I don't know if you've ever heard this story about Gary Pisoni up in Salem, Chicago. Similar thing. Just couldn't find water, and then went down really, really far. And I think he hit like the largest.
Yeah.
Water underground well in the area, and but while we're talking about that, for people who maybe don't know, I got all kinds of listeners, but like, talk about why it's important to have a water source on your vineyard,
and if you want, you know, speak to that, or like, you know, generally, obviously for us, we do deficit irrigation. We are trying to stress the vines, but it's all about balance from the vine to the wine. And we have to have enough canopy growth to get the phenolic ripeness. So that's, we don't grow Zinfandel here. If we grew Zinfandel, we might have other options, but we're doing Bordeaux and Rhones, and you know, that's the importance of it for us.
Yeah, I just want to add, being here in Paso, it is generally a pretty dry climate. The west side of Paso is more wet than the east side, for sure. So we get regular rainfall, but there's drought years regularly here. You know, there's years where we've had 6 inches of rain in a year here in Paso. That's like desert level rain. So having availability of water is just really important in grape growing, because if you don't have water, you know, you may not have a successful crop this year.
And why don't you pour some wine? What we got going on here? And while we're doing that, so for you, how old were you when your family acquired the property?
Yeah. So I was in my early 20s, and it was truly a partnership. My dad, we each had a financial piece, and we were looking for a property to kind of bring our family together. And we were all going through kind of an interesting point in our life. My sister was a chef at the Breakers Hotel, and then later at the Disney Swan and Dolphin. The financial collapse happened, and she was kind of thinking, what do I do with my life? And my dad was going through a divorce with my mother. And and I was in the publishing industry in New York, and I came out here for the tech industry, and I just didn't quite feel right. And so it was just an amazing moment, I think, when we came together, and it's been, you know, again, just the my relationship with Jada is really my relationship with my father.
So, what's it like to build something from nothing?
Really hard.
Same work out there.
I mean, it, you know, it looks glamorous and it's beautiful, and that's what drew us to Jada. And you were talking, you know, it's the old adage: it takes a lot of money to make a little money in the wine industry. And but that's, I think, what's always set us apart. My dad was the most amazing partner and owner. He didn't care about any of that. It was just about making the best wine, and everybody says that, but we didn't care if we lost money. He was just super focused on us being the best, and he wasn't just doing it for the Rhones. That was kind of, we were part of that first era when the rise of the Rhones in Paso, but he was way ahead of his time, thinking about Bordeaux's, and I think that's what makes Jada unique to Texel. That two top 100 wines with Jeff Dunnick in both Rhones and Bordeaux.
Yeah, and it's
sorry.
It's perfect. So that's fun. Same for you, because actually you said your father's an architect, so you've also probably seen a lot of, like, you've probably seen drawings in his office, and then a few years later there's a winery. What was that like, and how that influenced you in your life?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, the part of my dad's career that I always liked watching was seeing something physical being built. You know, like he would start, you know, years in advance, have drawings on paper. He would make models. Back in the day, they used to make like cardboard models.
Oh, yeah, for the CAD.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, years later, he'd see this building built, and he'd be able to go there and experience it with customers and see the winemakers working it. And that always seemed really fulfilling to me. Prior to working in the wine industry, I was working at Cal Poly. I was a graduate student, but I was working on and running marine fisheries research projects. And I always, one of the things I realized looking back on it is something I was missing from that was that tangible product to be built. So that's something that was very fulfilling for me once I got into the wine industry and got into winemaking, is you put all this time and effort into crafting this product for people to enjoy. And 2 years later, after that like super gnarly, intense harvest, you know, where you're just sweating like crazy or super tired, you get to go and see people enjoying that product, and it's just really fulfilling and really rewarding, I would say.
And so, Josh, what year did you guys start? First of all, yeah, what year did you start planting vines here?
So it was back in 1999, and I think we did it the right way. We knew we shouldn't just go right into winemaking. We sold to the big guys, Justin and Jay Lohr, but started working with some smaller producers. And I think like a lot of the winemakers around here, Scott Holly, we started making wine at dinner. And actually, 2005 was our first official vintage, but we made a couple of barrels in 2004. And dinner, it was an amazing area. Everybody was sort of doing wines there. So you got to, you know, we call it a community of sharing, but we got to meet all these amazing winemakers. Eric Jensen, that was our first meeting with him. And that's when we met Scott Holly. And when he agreed to make the wines for Jada, that's when we had the confidence to make our own wines.
And inside of that, how many, I believe you got 60 acres now on your vine?
Yep.
How many total acres are here on the property?
So it's a 100-acre ranch, and it's always been Rhones, Bordeaux, and Bordeaux's. And then we always throw in a couple little heirloom varieties. We call them heirloom varieties, but Scott loved Tannat. And that's really the secret behind Fat Hell's Kitchen. He's one of the, I think, the most talented and innovative blenders on the Central Coast. And that blend is now copied at Halter Ranch and even Dow. But Scott was the first to do it here with Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah. This is for you, Nate, because there are people, I think people, when thinking of most people, most wine consumers, not people who are here, but most wine consumers around the country, they hear Paso, they actually think Cabernet, they think J. Lohr, Going back, Liberty School, incredible. Valiant Liberty School was dope. It was like 12 bucks, 1990, and I was in the Lyman. I was like, this is good. Where's this pastoral role, Leslie? But for you, as the head winemaker, being a winemaker and speaker for a while, talk about some of the other varietals, like the Tannats, right? The you don't have it here, but Zinfandel, you know, even Graciano, Petit Verdot. Talk about some of the lesser known varietals that are planted that you get to work with by being here in Paso, particularly over here on the west side with you.
Yeah, so I mean, you said Tannat first, so I'll go with that. It's been a revelation working with Tannat on the property here. It's kind of a beast in the vineyard for sure. It grows, it's got massive leaves, it wants to make a massive canopy, and the clusters want to be gigantic as well. But we've found here on the west side of Paso, if you can kind of tame it in the vineyard, you can really make an incredible wine out of it. It's super dark always. There's as much tannin as you want in it, so you can kind of, as a winemaker, choose your own adventure. You know, you get to choose if you want to make a kind of smaller, more elegant, focused wine, or you can just make a big tannic beast. And so that's always kind of a fun project for us in the winemaking side, is deciding the style we want to make with that.
Really cool.
And actually, yeah, and then I'm going to hand it right back to you, because I always love this story. And I've got the story when I sat down with Mark Adams, like, got it right from the man himself, Justin Smith. But so for you guys, did you know you were planting Graciano when you planted, or you got caught up like, oh, that's not Mataro?
It was the healthiest one measure we'd ever seen.
Yeah. Like I said, I started here in 2017, and when I started here, we were still calling up Babette in the vineyard. But there was kind of always the assumption, like, this is a Babette. You know, like, super thick canes. Like, it was just a weird-looking Babette. And so eventually we just kind of embraced it. We looked at when we bought it, where we bought it from, where, like, we obviously have Graciano here. I think in 17 or 18 is when we finally kind of got the courage to just label it as Graciano on the bottle. And it's such an awesome grape for us to work with here as a winemaker. You know, it's super dark. It's got as much color as you want, for sure. But very, very low tannin. So it's an interesting wine on its own, in that if you look at it in the glass, you think it's going to just be this big tannic wine. But then you taste it, and it's almost watery by itself. So it's a great blender for us. It's a great co-fermenter. It's got a lot of savory characteristics, and also, like, especially on cooler years, just, like, pure black pepper. And so it just adds, like, that extra layer of complexity and just kind of interesting characteristics in our wine.
And this is going to be a question for both of you. We'll start with you, Josh, because you've been here longer than Nate has. Talk about when you first planted the first vines. What was your farming practices when you guys, your first few years of starting out?
probably a little rough. it's very, very commercial farming. We were farming, you know, it's very common. We were growers, so yeah. You kind of go through that transition. And then the breakthrough was really we had happened to steal the reserve winemaker from Charles Krug, a man named David Galdonado, and he came to us and wanted to do biodynamic farming, and we my dad's a scientist by nature, so he's a little skeptical. But we did have him skin a gopher, which, having a surgeon, he was really good at it. But we worked with Philippe Amanier. He made it so relatable to kind of our approach, which was, my dad was a big fan of Alice Fearing and just the simplicity of it, the ecosystem, and that. So now we've been 10 years organic, and how we farm is, night and day from 20 years ago.
Yeah, and since Josh Harp and myself took over, you know, the grape growing and winemaking in 2017, we were already using organic practices. We kind of moved a little bit away from the biodynamics. It's, for a small winery, it's very labor intensive. I think there's good things that come out of it. But we kind of try to still maintain some of those practices, but we're not strict with biodynamics for sure. So fortunately in 2022, we were purchased by the Rivoli family, San Antonio Winery. And, you know, we told them the history of our farming, and we told them we're organic. We're very dedicated to organic. As a winemaker, I want to be able to go out in the vineyard anytime and not worry about what they just sprayed, and I can taste grapes while I'm out there and not even think about it. And they said, well, if we're doing that, we might as well get certified. And so they made it official, and we got certified by CCOF as organic in the vineyard a couple of years ago.
Okay, so another friend of Song's, Alyssa Jacobson, on the podcast, and who has land down in San Ynez. Josh, what does CCOF stand for? Our name?
It's, you know.
Yeah, you don't know. She didn't know either. This is the best.
Wait, I just looked at it. California Certification.
That's what Song's here for, huh?
No, it's not. Oh, it's so cool. It's just so funny because she was talking about CCOF. Yeah. I've heard of it. So I was like, well, it's initials.
Yeah.
What's it stand for? She's like, California. Like, we got it.
Well, we're nervous.
Yeah. I want to just dive a little bit deeper into that because you were the CFO. So, and you mentioned this about talk about there are realities of farming. Like, so you mentioned Alice Fire, and she was over in Beaujolais, and you know, you have the big four from Colonel Lynch, but like she, someone took a picture and like they're spraying over in Beaujolais, and you know, people are getting mad. But talk about some of the realities when you first started winemaking and what it is to be a farmer and have to produce.
Yeah. I mean, it was trying for us. I mean, we're city folk to see sprays and that. You know, I was just talking about this. We noticed with the commercial sprays, we live on the property, and we were getting headaches, and you can read all the data you want, but there was just something that obviously just so appealing about organic, and we drink the water on. I mean, that's the wild thing about being a vineyard. You're not on public electricity, water. You're the steward, and for us, that's why I made it so easy. It was, and people, I think, overstate the financial expense. It's a really elegant solution, at least for small brands, for the farming we want to do.
Yeah, I would just add too, with, you know, not only is it better for the land we're farming, I think it's more sustainable in the long run. It's created an ecosystem, a more wholesome ecosystem that's more resilient to diseases and more resilient to pests and whatnot. But it also leads to better quality of wines. I mean, I think that you've seen it as a trend in Paso, for sure, on the west side of Paso. More and more small wineries are farming organically. And I think part of that is just because you need to be more attentive to your farming. You need to be more mindful of timing of practices. And that's good for keeping the vines healthy, but also for making high quality wine.
Yeah. And talk about big mindfulness, right? So now we're getting all the woo-woo stuff, right? When we started, I'm Pamela Strayer commenting on my shit because I was like, listen, I'm behind biodynamic farming, but Rudolf Steiner led a cult, sorry.
Right, yeah.
So, you got to separate, you know, it's pulling out the good, right?
Yeah, pull the good out. You know?
But with that, making better wines, what was your experience farming-wise working here before you got here? Like, what most of the vineyards, were they biodynamic or organic? What were the farming practices you worked with?
So the first winery I worked at in Paso, Sextant, not biodynamic, not organic, also not really estate-driven. It was a bigger winery, so yeah. We were working with a bunch of different fruit. And I didn't even really get any vineyard experience while I was there. We were not making wine on the vineyard. So, but the last winery I was at Kukula, which is northwest of here. It's kind of out in the boonies of Paso. Beautiful property. It's dry farmed, organically farmed as well. While I was there, he was working towards organic certification, but I'm not sure if he ever got it. But he also lived on the property. And so he kind of had the same approach. He's like, if I'm going to live here, I want to be a good steward of this land, and I want to be like, keep my family healthy and safe while I'm here as well. So, and he was a very quality minded, high quality, grape grower while there. So yeah, it was equivalent to here for sure.
It's going to go right back to you. What's in the glass right now? because I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, so this is our 2021 Hell's Kitchen. Hell's Kitchen is our, I like to call it our New World Rhone blend. So it's always kind of Syrah focused. That makes up the backbone of this wine. This one's about 45% Syrah, 32% Graciano, and then the rest is Grenache. So the Syrah makes up the backbone, and it makes up the density, texture, mouthfeel. The Grenache, to me, it defines the aromatic characteristics of this wine. So you get that bright red fruit, especially, or this is a 2021, so it's pretty young. And so you get really bright red, almost candied fruit. We use about 40 to 50% new oak on it, depending on the vintage. And we're using kind of spicier oak barrels, large format, but we're looking to add some spice and some kind of interesting complexity and characteristics from the oak there as well. And then Graciano, as I mentioned, it can have that savory kind of peppery spice to it. So that adds some kind of layers of complexity also.
Cool. You've been drinking these wines for a while. What do you think this vintage?
The 21, it ranks up there with, I think, it's got top two or three vintages for Tatum. Yeah, they really, you know, we brought in Eric Jensen and Tony Biaggi back. Eric started working with us back in 2016 as our viticulturalist, and he really loved, I think he had his eye on the Cabernet here, and then some Syrah. You know, he and my dad just hit it off, and it was amazing when he agreed to be our consulting winemaker in 17, and I totally lost track of your question, awesome. But what was the question?
Oh, what did you get? The wine.
Yes. The top 20. Yes. So we started that, and, you know, by 18, I think we kind of had things dialed in, and Nate and Josh really were leading the effort, and that's why we had the confidence to just make them our winemaking team, and Tony was a great guide and consultant. And so 21 turned out to be a lot like, you know, we got it. It wasn't 2020. and we had amazing, big wines, big color, and just tons of tannin. So I love what they've done.
Yeah, I would say on the Rhone side for us in 2021, it's probably my favorite vintage for our Rhone since I've been working here. Tannins galore, you know, as much tannin as you want in a wine. So we kind of had to be restrained in our winemaking. But for our Rhones, the tannins were like very fine grain. And so it's made for a very like luscious, elegant wine. And Hell's Kitchen is always a crowd pleaser. It's just a flashy, like exciting, interesting wine. So I think 21 was a very, very good vintage for it because of that.
Yeah. And so this being the 2021, one of the last
final.
So having built this with your dad, just like what was it like when you guys made the decision to sell, and what was kind of like, what was that like for you, that transition?
Yeah. You know, I think the emotions didn't get in, took a year or two, you know, it was really last year that it kind of set in. But for me, you know, I was the only family member to be out here every day for 14 years. And, you know, it just felt ready for me. I just made some beautiful wines, especially starting by 19. We just were kind of rocking, and we knew these wines were going to be good. We didn't know how the critics were going to receive them, but we felt like you do start to feel like a steward of the brand, and you want to honor your customers, and we just felt. We had a look at, okay, what's the next step? And it was going to be a big investment. And it just felt like the right time. And we were just all in a good place in our life. When we came here, it was, my sister was going through work transitions. My parents had divorced. I had left New York. Without getting morbid, my two cousins had died in a plane crash. Oh. And I think we all just found ourselves here. And it just...
We have like in your lives.
Yeah, it just felt like a nice time to, and we love the Rivolis. They just appealed to me. They were an Italian family. They'd been here 100 years, and family was really important to us. And there was just something that I sensed that they would bring those values to the team here. And the biggest thing, first thing I asked them was, are you going to keep the team here? And they said yes. And that was, I believe them, and they've honored that, and they haven't. You know, everybody says, "Oh, they're never going to change it." They really haven't. We are doing the same thing we do. So some people kind of looked at it as like an odd partnership, but if you think of them and what they're trying to do, it actually makes a lot of sense that Jada is part of their portfolio.
That's fine. No, and you're right. I mean, you look at what has happened. Booker going to a Constellation. Dow is
Treasury.
Yeah.
Treasury,
yep. Yeah. Whatever. Only someone from Australia would do that. You know, like, I don't know if I was like, whoa, you know, you know, and it may, I mean, people are, this is the hot new Appalachian, right?
Yeah.
So for a family that's been here, San Antonio, been making wines for over 100 years, and like, why not shore up and make a play where you're at? I mean, before some, I mean, people were going to come anyway, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, I want to ask about the wine, to go back, like, this is a little text sheet. I said I'm talking about, but I'm just curious as I'm drinking this. Co-fermented, whole clustered, completely stemmed. What are you doing there?
So yeah, this wine is made up of I think probably 5 or 6 different individual fermentations.
Okay.
And at least 2 of those are co-fermentations, Syrah and Graciano. Generally, with our logistics during harvest, we try to co-ferment Syrah and Graciano a good amount because it really works for us here at Jada. We've got the fruit and the density of Syrah and the color from Graciano and the spice from Graciano. About, I would say probably most of this, the Syrah Graciano is from co-ferment. There is stem inclusion on the Graciano side. We did about 10% of the Graciano that's in there, has some stem inclusion as well. So that just kind of adds some spice, adds some aromatic uplift as well.
Now, we don't have one on here a little bit, but like also this morning, you tasted me through the lime. The board, and you basically like, was it because your father was such a Bordeaux lover that like he came out here and then he's like, yeah, I see what you're doing, but yeah, in Bordeaux.
Yeah, yeah. My dad's you know, obviously I think he's an amazing guy, but it's wild. I mean, he bought boats and he knows nothing about boats, but I'm going to read a book. Yeah. So that's what he did with wine. He just has that confidence. I think it comes from being a surgeon and you know, truly save people's lives. And I mean, he's a massive reader like I am. And he's like, we're going to do it. And he never flinched. Even with Merlot, everybody thought we were crazy. Scott didn't even want to make the wine. And my dad's like, no, that's one of our, he thought at the time, one of our best looking blocks. And now, you know, we're one of only 2 Paso wineries that have a Merlot that's gotten over 95 points. So without his, just, it's not hubris, just the confidence that, well, we're going to figure it out.
I would add, you know, just observing Josh and Jack's relationship over the years when they were working together, Jack definitely was the dreamer, you know. He always would come to Josh with the ideas, and Josh was the one on site, and he was managing the finances, and be like, Dad, we can't, like, what do you think of me? Like, we definitely can't afford that. So it's always been a funny dynamic to watch.
Yeah. I find it very interesting that, like, your father has to be, a doctor has to be pragmatic, right? They're not,
you would think.
They're not necessarily, right? Like, there's lives at stake, right? but I think it's so interesting, like, but that is actually, there's a great book called Rocket Fuel, and it talks about the problem with a lot of startups and organizations, like, you have 2 dreamers. You actually need an instigator or someone who's going to rein you in and orchestrate things, like, you know, like for me, when I started this podcast, like if I didn't have a producer when I first started, it wouldn't happen because it's just too much for me to do. Like, you know, but I think so. You went to this relationship. Like, what was it like first time you tell your dad no?
my dad's very Italian. He's Santo, the new company, is very much the same way.
Yeah,
they keep asking.
And where with them.
So, you kind of, you act like you didn't hear it. And then if they keep asking, then you know, okay, this is super important. And then my job was to, honestly, that's how I looked at it. I gotta figure it out. And I think that's what I'm most proud of is, I mean, I love that I got an opportunity. I truly took it like, I want to learn everything. These aren't easy things to figure out the financing on. And it was scary at times, but I'm really proud that I was able to do that.
But when you were talking about, keep asking, I just flashed back to that scene in The Sopranos where Tony was talking about, he's like, my father was the toughest son of a bitch.
Yeah,
my dad was and he's like, and my mother wore him down to a little bit. No, just grind you down.
Yeah, my mom would have never let him do it. So it's good they were divorced.
Speaking of which, let's taste a second wine, because at some point that wine has to have something to do with your mother, New Jersey girl, right?
No.
So, okay, yeah. What's in the bar of the New Jersey girl?
Yeah. So I should tell a little bit about Hell's Kitchen. My grandmother grew up there. It's not the restaurant or the show. It really
is. It's like legit.
It's New legit York, New York. Yes.
Gangs of New York.
And I love it. It's like a crazy take on a classic GSM. And I call it the iconic class in our lineup. So I love it. I love everything. I love that Scott broke all the rules and they continued that. But Jersey Girl was really, it's a sweet story. It's just my dad's love letter to his new wife, Robin. She is the most patient, understanding. I mean, most wives would not put up with the crazy stuff we did to build this. And she loved my dad so much. She knew it made him happy, and her favorite variety was Syrah. So his first thought was, "I'm gonna." And he loved Bruce Springsteen. So she's from Neptune, New Jersey. So that's how we got her Jersey Girl.
Yeah, I mean, she's definitely a different Jersey Girl. Usually not that patient. That's why I'm married. Yeah. My wife's from Connecticut.
In the south.
Like Jersey Girls, but that's a beautiful story. I mean, that's it. The Springsteen song, like, down at the Jersey Shore, right? She's from Neptune, so that's so, so cool. So as a winemaker, when you're looking at, like, these are two bottles that kind of represent his family history. Do you feel a sense of duty every vintage when you're out there making decisions on what you're gonna, how you're gonna, pick and bottle and blend?
To be honest, I
think I'm a fan of the coffee. That's why I'm answering the questions.
No, I mean, we're kind of more thinking about the brand and the history of the brand. The name on the bottle means something to the family, certainly, but to us, it's always just been part of the brand, and so we're trying to be true to what that wine has been in the past. So. Yeah, the Jersey Girl is Syrah. The base of this wine is a Syrah Viognier Coferment. So it's a Coverty style. We kind of use the history of Coverty winemaking to craft this wine. This one's about 90% Syrah and then equal parts Viognier and Graciano. And I really like the Coferment of Viognier and Syrah because you get kind of a very different aromatic profile, and especially when this wine is young, so it's a 2021. Again, we're getting then like kind of perfumey notes from the Viognier. We actually use some whole cluster in the Viognier for this vintage as well, and so I think that just kind of added to the density and the intensity of the aromatics from the Viognier. But we also get, I think, a little bit of an interesting texture too, because Viognier and Syrah have kind of different tannin makeups, and so you get kind of some layers on the mouthfeel that's not present in just straight Syrah.
Josh, I can't believe I stepped over this. Where'd the name Jada come from?
My family's from Sicily, and part of the family were fishermen, and they apparently had a fishing boat named Jada, and we just didn't want. We didn't want to have a Messina family vineyard. There was one already up in, I believe it's in Napa. And I love that my dad went that way. He was in San Diego Harbor. This boat was going across named Jada. And he was like, I think it's serendipity. And it reminded him oddly of his dad's voyage to the United States, and we love it. It's kind of has Jada is its own thing. It's mysterious. And you love female names, and everybody can kind of bring whatever they want to the name at this point. It's not named after a dog or anything.
All right, so I don't know who your social media team is, but you need to do like a clip with your dad, like a reel.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, right. And what you do is you stand up there and start shit talking Jersey girl. And then your dad can come up and go, "Keep my wine's name out your mouth." That shit will go viral.
All right, I like that.
Like, you weren't a little uneasy after the Oscars that year?
Oh, yeah.
You guys are sitting Chris Rock occasionally.
Yeah.
It's all in here. It'll be hilarious. This CCOF, that has, I graduated from law school. I'm not a lawyer because I can't do that much paperwork. That has to be a process. How long did that actually take to come to fruition?
Nate, spearhead it.
Yeah, so it is like the initial process is quite rigorous. They have a long application process. They're asking about
shout out, man.
It's not a weird farm history, and you've got to collect the documents and show the sprays you've used in the past and everything. So since we have been farming organically, the burden was on us to prove to them that was the case. And then once you submit the application, there's an audit. So somebody comes in and inspects the vineyard. But now that we're in CCOF, there's an annual audit as well, but it's less rigorous really than the first. And it's, paperwork, it's filing paperwork once a year. And fortunately, we have a larger vineyard team now, and we've got a guy internally that's taking over that process. So it's made it a little easier for me, certainly.
So you still live on the property, is that?
I do.
You do? Okay. And kind of what is the day to day of the general manager of an estate winery?
Well, even with the Rivoli's, it starts really early. So I'm usually up by 3:30. I'm either emailing still to this day with my dad. Half the time politics, so that's, yeah, that's the wildest thing of when you own these. I never realized that, I've worked for tech companies, but I love that about a vineyard to small business. I mean, you're always thinking about it. It's always in your head. So you come here and then get my team oriented and you kind of do everything still. I do marketing still. I do label design. And that's the cool thing about a small brand is, and why, even the small brands today, these are people that have been there since the very beginning. They're not a generation removed. They know where everything, where everybody is buried. So, and then you're here late, and you don't take a lot of vacations.
I probably have asked this before, but I've never asked it to you, Nate. So you were the assistant winemaker, and kind of how has your role changed going from assistant winemaker to head winemaker? And if you could talk about, I know there's phases in making wine, like kind of walk through like what a head winemaker does during prudence season and bud break. Kind of walk through the stages of winemaking and how it's changed for you now that you're the head winemaker.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest change certainly is just the responsibility is mine now. I'm the one that's making the decisions and making the final call. But I was fortunate enough that, so Josh, our previous winemaker, hired me in 2017. We knew each other before we started working together. So we already, had a rapport. We got along very well. And it was his first, at Jada, it was his first job as a head winemaker as well. And so I got to kind of grow into that role with him and watch him grow into the role. And so that kind of gave me a template for kind of how to approach it as I became a winemaker as well. And I was fortunate also that he took a collaborative approach to winemaking with me. He knew that I was dedicated to the craft and very scientific minded. So, he wasn't going to leave me behind with the technical aspects of winemaking. And so I would say, like, I'm fortunate in that I had a mentor that was very, leaned on me quite a bit for a lot of responsibilities. So that step to winemaking, it was intimidating, certainly, initially, but immediately once I started doing it, I was like, oh, I know how to do this, you know? And so we just finished pruning the vineyard right now, and I was out there in the vineyard helping the vineyard crew and teaching them what I've done. And, you know, I was unsure about it at first, but as they're doing it, I'm seeing the results. I'm like, they're doing the right thing, you know? So I certainly absorbed what I watched when I was working with Josh, for sure.
Check that, Josh. Send this to Chris Rock with a note that says, put your wine in your mouth. and then maybe he'll do an Instagram post, and then, like, you'll be sold. And not that you have any problems selling.
No, that, no. I won't
but,
so.
But, you know, lines are good for business, man. Oh, you might have a backup. You talked about some of the critical acclaim. I want to talk to you, Josh, because I like scores just because they're goalposts, right? And we understand. Like, when people, I'm like, listen, when people say, oh, scores, I'm like, well, you must have got a 500 SAT.
Because that's right.
In America, scores matter. Right? Yeah. Like, yeah, whoever has more points in a game wins. Right? when you and Josh Harper make the wine, are you making wines to make the best wines that you can give in this vineyard? Or are you specifically, because a lot of people talk about the parkerization of wine and making wines specifically for palates. Now it will be Jeb Dunnick is probably the preeminent of big wines right now. Is that something to back your mind, or is it just, you're just trying to make the best wine you think possible from the terroir?
I would say 100% the latter. You know, when I started in 2017, we hired Tony Biaggi on as our consulting winemaker. He's a very, well-established winemaker. He's made a number of 100-point wines. And so he kind of just taught us, trust the process, you know, you follow your instincts, do what you think is best. But the ultimate goal at a winery like this, we're 100% estate-driven. We're sitting here in the middle of the vineyard. All of our, for the 7 years I was here, or I've been here, almost all of our grapes that we make into wine come from the vineyard around us. And so our goal is just to express this estate. And we had faith, you know, just knowing the area and knowing our neighbors and how well they do with scores and with the critics. If we were able to do that in a genuine fashion, then the scores would follow. But I've never been a score hunter. You know, I'm competitive, but not in that sense, because it's definitely under control. Like, you submit your wines, and then you're just like, all right, we'll see if they like it or not. And everybody's palate's different, and everybody's preference is different. You know, everybody has some bias when they see a bottle or a label, you know, if they've heard of it or not. And so there's so many factors that are out of your control that, like, we can't stress too much about it. We just need to make the best wine we can. And the ultimate goal is to sell wine. So as long as it's selling, like,
No, that totally makes sense, right? I mean, I think people, it is the wine business. I mean, like, okay, maybe we can't make money. Can we break even? Right. And make some good juice and, you know. Get to live in a beautiful place.
Yeah.
So, Josh, talk about a time, like, what has been your biggest challenge? What was one of the biggest challenges you had to overcome in the process of getting to here today with Jada Winery and Vineyards?
Biggest challenge. I mean, obviously it definitely starts with the vineyard. We had been working with a company who was one of my dad's best friends, and they had done, you know, an amazing job and helped us get on the map, but sometimes somebody just takes you so far, and to make that change and to risk it, my dad, thankfully, he was always supportive. If he wanted to do it, he would say go for it. So I think making the changes in the vineyard, bringing in, and the toughest challenge with all of this is just getting the right team. We had a winemaker that had a lot of the theories that we use right now, and he was implementing them, but he didn't always fully have the tools from us, and vice versa. And I'd be remiss if I didn't, you know, what I love about our wines is it's a family, but I really see, especially in these vintages through 2021, Josh and Nate were best friends. I mean, you're truly seeing a partnership. And I think their passion and their joy for working with each other, you know, comes through.
It could be here or it could be anywhere. People want it. It was one of the biggest, like, oh shit, like, I don't know if it's going to work. Like, moment I know that sometimes wasn't that you kind of overcome during your winding loop.
That's pretty far. I came into winemaking pretty late in my life. I was almost 30 years old when I started making. And so just making that jump and fully committing to it, the initial process of, you know, going and submitting resumes and meeting with my winemakers. But once I experienced the process, it was not hard at all. You know, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. So, yeah.
We're going to wrap up in a few minutes, but before we do, some fun, this is all I know, but some fun questions I want to ask both of you. And I'll just ask a question. Josh, your hand to Nate. All right, so given all you've been through, career changes, what advice would you give to your 14-year-old self?
Chill out, right? It's gonna be okay. It's all gonna lead to something. I mean, I kind of went all over the map. I'm a perfect example of, you can start, you know, I was an artsy kid at Stanford, and you can go from writing. I was at Columbia for grad school, and then I went into finance and fell in love with algorithms, and then it ended up being, you know, 14 years day to day, but now 20-year career in the wine industry. So be open to everything. It all adds up to something. Even working for restaurants, I never thought I'd ever in college. Like, it was a huge help working, you know, managing a tasting room team in hospitality. So I just say, yeah, try everything. And you're going to find it. And once you find it, obsess about it. Like, don't give yourself the space to just go as deep as you can.
Yeah, I would say for me, it's, you know, be more ambitious and be more confident in your decision-making. You know, it took me a long time to transition from my science career to winemaking, but a big part of that is just because I was very comfortable about where I was and I didn't have anything pushing me away from it. So, you know, I think if I was more ambitious as a young person, I probably would have gotten here sooner because it was always something I thought of doing and wanted to do. So, it's kind of be ambitious, take chances.
Great. Thank you. Next question. Who would you most like to have a bottle of wine with? Could be any person, dead or alive.
I'm a writer at heart. I would want to have a bottle of wine with you. She's my all-time favorite wife writer. I want to hear how her brain works, the real person. So, yeah, that's the person for me.
I honestly don't have a great answer to this question. I'm not a, you know, celebrity person. I don't like, I like music, you know, maybe a musician that I like, but you know, like, I love Bob Marley, so maybe Bob Marley would put it around that Bob Marley. I don't hold celebrities super high.
Totally, that's fair. All right, so I play this game. I'm going to give you both three different grapes, so they're going to be different for both of you, okay? And it's called slap, lick, fondle. You slap one grape, lick the other one, and get the fondle one. Okay, so, Josh, I'm going Bordeaux with you. I'm going Merlot, Cabernet, and Petit Verdot. No, screw that. I'm going Merlot, Tannat, Petit Verdot.
Yeah, I gotta make a little tough.
Merlot, Tannat, Petit Verdot.
Yep. Which one do you slam?
Definitely Fondle, Petit Verdot. Okay. It's my favorite Bordeaux variety. I want to just bathe in it. Lick. Ooh. Probably Tannat. There's something like subtle, as big as it is. I think people, if you do it right, it's got this, I call it undercurrent. That's just really elegant. And then Cabernet, I mean, it's one of my, one of the things I'm most proud of here, but yeah, smack me around.
All right. And then here for Nate, we're going to go, I'm going to go Rhone for you. So we're going to do Grenache, Syrah. Actually, you know what? No, I'm going to go different for you because I always think it's fascinating to see what winemakers drink outside of what they make. Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Sauvignon Blanc. What's when you slap what you're doing my phone?
So, yeah. I'd say, you know, starting with slap, that's the easiest to me. It was Pinot Noir. I've never really made Pinot Noir. I love it, but, you know, slap it out of the way. And then, yeah, I think Sauv Blanc, actually, I made my first Sauv Blanc in 2023, and I love, like, I'm just obsessed with Sauv Blanc right now. So I would fondle Sauv Blanc. Is that how that works?
Yeah.
And it's not least late for Chardonnay. Yeah. I mean, I love Chardonnay also. We make Chardonnay now as well.
Yeah, you said a little, you have a little project, right?
Yeah, there's we have a small block of Chardonnay on one of the companies.
Chardonnay from Paso Robles?
From Paso Robles, yes. And it doesn't, it's a really cool, like, it's a half-acre block.
It's wild.
Little pocket on the west side of Paso here. And it just makes this incredible, like, very, like, citrusy, very fresh, zesty Chardonnay from Paso. Like, it doesn't fit. So, yeah, I'm whatever was left for that one.
There you go.
Chardonnay.
All right, last question for you both. Just pass the mic over. What are you most excited about for the future? And this could either be in your personal life or for the future of Jada Vineyards.
For Jada... I mean, I would have said a couple months ago, the Sauv Blanc project. Yeah. I mean, it's been 10 years we've talked about this, and it was just crazy. Josh and I were talking about, I was talking about Dragonette. He happened to reach out to Vogelsang Vineyard. It just, like, all sort of came together. And I'm intrigued and intimidated by, we have a special little Bordeaux project where we can't talk about yet, but so for Jada and then for me, I'm excited to move off property. So.
It's easy for you though. This is an easy one for me. Like, professionally, I'm excited about being the winemaker. Like, this is my first vintage of getting to make pick decisions, getting to make fermentation decisions. Like, this is what I got into winemaking for. So I'm just, like, so stoked. I couldn't be happier about that. Then personally, also very easy. My wife, I was telling you earlier, is 9 months pregnant. She's due, we're our second baby in 2 days. You know, I've been feeling my phone this whole time, wondering if I'm going to get the call. So yeah, super. I'm just so stoked on my growing family right now.
That's awesome. But however, you know, this is last for posterity. Your child's in here is like, Daddy, you didn't see me first. The baby.
Here
we go.
That's right.
You're coming. Good answer.
All right. So, Josh, tell everybody how they can find you, Jada Vineyards, be a part of what you guys are doing here at Jada Vineyards Possible.
Yeah, either. Love to follow us on social media, on Instagram, Jada Winery is our handle. Go to our website, jadavineyard.com. Sometimes people put an S, or we always highlight that we're an estate, so we've always called ours Led with Jada Vineyard. Or email us at info@jadavineyard.com. We're open 7 days a week. We are always going to respond to you.
Yeah, or come to the winery. I'm working here 5 days a week. You know, if you come during the week, come ask and talk to the winemaker. If I'm available, I'll come say hi.
Awesome. Thank you so much, guys, for being here, sharing these wines, making this happen. This was really a lot of fun. All the listeners out there, make sure to check out the show notes. That's where I'll put info about the wines we drank. I'll put links to their socials and you know, their website. And I just want to thank everybody for who's listened to the Black Wine Guy Experience. Over the past 4 years, this is the last episode of that, but you know, I'm not going away, but this is really cool to come here, and you guys are getting something that was recorded on a Friday, and it's going to go out the next Monday. I love it. Super fresh, So until the next time, cheers to Mavericks, philosophers, and all the deep thinkers, all you wine drinkers. Your boy MJ saying peace.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you learned something. You had some fun while you were here. Please subscribe to the podcast and give us a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening to. And if you want to be an insider and get special content, make sure you go over to blackwineguy.com and get on our email list.